has to wants to become a more influential country, it needs to cooperate with the region's countries. Now, of course, it also has problems with China, and so it needs to further its clout on the economic level with countries in Asia. And Iran happens to be very well located at the geographic level. So naturally, India will have to pick up or increase its relations with Iran.
Now, Mr. Sharara, how does the West view this visit by the Iranian foreign minister to India and its implications and the tensions over their stance on Ukraine?
Okay, as far as the West goes, of course, they're not in favor of India picking up with relations with Iran. Of course, it's not within their interests. They want an isolated Iran, and they don't want India having anything to do with it. However, look, if you go back to recent history, relations between India with Iran have been very formal. There hasn't been a lot of follow through, even though both countries have signed many agreements with one another. So if you look at this recent history, you realize that that this follow through is a lot of it is because of U.S. pressure or because many Indian companies are afraid of the possibility of sanctions. So okay, they're up to signing agreements with Iran so that they can secure a possible future. But the fear of sanctions has them keeping a step behind, so to speak. So the West naturally doesn't look favorably upon any improvement in relations between Iran and India.
Now, Mr. Sharara, you've mentioned the sanctions. Now, will sanctions affect the extent of trade and economic development? Or does this willingness to expand ties signal another blow to U.S. and EU attempts at controlling the global market?
Okay, as far as sanctions go, as I just said, there's a lot of fear of sanctions from India, and this has kept both countries from taking their ties up to a new level. When you have so many agreements that haven't been implemented, with Indian companies afraid of investing in the Iranian market for fear of U.S. sanctions, this shows you how the impact of the sanctions has been an impediment. It's been impeding the progress of relations between the two countries. However, the readiness of the fact that Amir Abdullahian has visited India, this in and of itself signifies that India is prepared to overcome some of its problems with the EU and the or some of the implications that this may cause with the EU and the US, because as I said, the US and the EU are currently preoccupied with Ukraine. And also, India has to reinforce its Asian depth, its Asian identity. Of course, India is a huge market for the West, and the West needs it more than India needs the West, first of all. Second of all, after the problems that have happened with Ukraine and the fact that India was prepared to stand up to the West in order to secure or keep its relations secure with Russia and to a larger extent with its neighbors in Central Asia, this shows that we're now seeing, hopefully, what can be the beginning of a restructuring in Indian foreign policy. Hopefully, unless the West is able to exert additional pressure in order to keep India from doing this.
Thank you, Mr. Sharara, for being on the program. Now, let's see what people had to say on social media.
Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi hails the centuries-old civilizational links between India and Iran and notes that relations between the two countries have promoted regional security and prosperity. Dr. S. Jaishankar, India's foreign minister, following his meeting with Iranian counterpart Hossein Amir Abdullahian, says both sides reviewed bilateral cooperation, including in trade, connectivity, health, and people-to-people ties. Financial securities analyst Sanjeev Basin points to growing cooperation between Iran and India by citing the report about first transfer of Russian goods to India through a new trade corridor that transits Iran.
You're listening to The Subcontinent, broadcast by IRIB English Radio. This weekly program reviews ongoing developments in India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. Listen to The Subcontinent every Monday here on IRIB English Radio.
Offensive remarks made by two BJP officials about the Prophet of Islam and the inevitable wrath of Muslims seems to threaten India's political and economic ties with Muslim countries, a real risk that could prove detrimental to its economic ties with key trade partners and the main energy supplies for the nation. Shortly after their insults, BJP national spokesperson Nupur Sharma and Naveen Kumar Jindal, who is the chief of the party's media cell, apologized for their comments. Nupur Sharma was suspended and Naveen Kumar was expelled from the party. But the wrath of the Muslim community, which has been facing discrimination and hate campaigns for years, led to violent protests across the country.
Offensive remarks by Nupur Sharma, BJP's national spokesperson, during a televised debate, and Naveen Jindal's controversial social media post on religious values were followed by worldwide condemnation by Muslims. India witnessed unprecedented public outcry. From East to West Asia, the Persian Gulf and Northern Africa, India's ambassadors were summoned and official statements were issued by various countries condemning the acts of sacrilege and requesting decisive action by the Indian government. The Organization for Islamic Cooperation said in a statement, "These cases of defamation are part of a growing spate of hatred and defamation of Islam in India and systematic practices against Indian Muslims, particularly in light of a set of decisions to prohibit the use of hijab in educational institutions in some Indian states, including demolition of Muslims' properties and growing violence against them." Later, the Indian Foreign Ministry released a statement rejecting the offensive comments and tweets, stressing that these are the views of individuals and do not represent the values of the Indian government. But all the efforts made by BJP officials failed to suppress the public outcry of Muslims and stop nationwide protests. Thousands of Muslims in India, Bangladesh, Pakistan, and other Muslim countries took to the streets to protest. The protests led to violence in India, leaving few dead and dozens injured, adding to India's long history of anti-Islam sentiments. Thousands of commentators had predicted that the pressure would lead to Muslims' reprisals, which can lead to a new series of ethnic and religious tensions.
The founders of a free India, including Jawaharlal Nehru, made the right decision to create a secular state, and one of the reasons for the decision was to accommodate the plethora of ethnic and religious identities in the nation. But since the BJP came into power, discriminatory and extremist policies implemented against Muslims have created a tense atmosphere in the country. Despite the emphasis of the Indian constitution on its secular nature, pressures against the Muslim minority seem to be intensifying as of late. They started with the implementation of extremist regulations against religious minorities, but have led to beating and even killing of Muslims and the demolition of the houses by extremists.
Muslims form 13% of India's total population. This 200 million strong population that has peacefully coexisted with other religious communities has become alienated from the rest of the nation following British colonialist rule and their policy of divide and conquer. This divide was exacerbated by the rise of the BJP and the party's provoking anti-Muslim sentiments in the public, leading to animosity from the minority Muslim population. Judging by the Babri Mosque case and the annexation of Kashmir's administrative authority, the Indian nationality law increased pressure against women wearing hijab, and thousands of small instances of harassment of Muslims, a re-evaluation of the performance of Indian officials when it comes to harassment of minorities, seems inevitable. In the recent case of insults against sacred values of Muslims on India's media and social media platforms, the issue has been stretched beyond religious disputes among the nation, becoming a global issue. Analysts believe that the party's reaction to the issue will not be sufficient, and if senior members of the Indian government and its ruling party fail to present an appropriate public response, their ties with other Muslim countries may become undone. 57 members of the Organization of Islamic Cooperation have demanded decisive action by the Indian government to discipline those who insulted the Prophet. If a $90 billion trade agreement with the Gulf Cooperation Council in 2020 to 2021 is at risk, not to mention the work and livelihood of millions of Indians living in its member states, India will be facing a serious challenge on its path to becoming a global powerhouse, because it will need the energy supply and the export market.
Now, to talk more on this, we are joined by Mr. Clifton de Rosario, General Secretary at All India Lawyers Association for Justice. Mr. Rosario, welcome to the program. Now, the protests in response to the derogatory comments against Prophet Muhammad have taken India by storm, but is this backlash unexpected after the continuous harassment of Muslims across the country?
Okay. What we're witnessing right now, in our country is really posing some very crucial questions of our nation in terms of how we go forward from here, what the idea of this country is going to be. One really shouldn't be too surprised. The Islamophobic statements that were made, the kind of bigotry that we are seeing, the targeting of the Muslims in a sense, which basically is premised on the understanding that Muslims and other minorities, as has always been the case with Dalits, are second-class citizens in this country. That message that is being sought to be drilled into the daily lives of Muslims by state and non-state actors. This, I think, is an extremely challenging time, as it were. And obviously, the Muslim community is not taking this lying down, and they are responding to it. The kind of protest that we saw when the government tried to force down the Citizenship Amendment Act down the throats of people over here.
Mr. Rosario, we know that the Muslim community in India has been discriminated against since the BJP came into power, but after the suspension of anti-Islam political figures, do you think the political pressure is finally working?
The fact that, the BJP national spokesperson, Nupur Sharma, and the party's, BJP's Delhi media head, Naveen Kumar Jindal, could so brazenly such vicious Islamophobic statements is something that I think we have to really take note of. It reflects the kind of bigotry that is running amok in our country. In that sense, it was obvious that there was going to be some kind of a public outrage against it, as also some kind of international pressure as well. And no doubt, we saw that several states, whether it's Qatar, Saudi Arabia, Iran, Malaysia, etc., who all came out in strong condemnation of it. And of course, the threat at that point was the boycott of Indian goods. That seemed to have played a big role in the government that's coming out with the statement that these are fringe elements. And then, of course, expelling them from the party. One really needs to read between the lines over here. How can they be called fringe? In fact, right now, the slogan that is going across the country is that gali gali mein shor hai, fringe nahi ye core hai. That means everybody knows for sure that these so-called fringe are actually the core. So what both of them have said is something that is being said every day in the media. It is being said in the hate speeches, in the Dharam Sansads. It's being said all across the country.
Mr. Razavia, Muslim countries have condemned the many cases of Islamophobia-fueled comments by BJP officials and demanded an appropriate response by the government. So how can the BJP government mend the damage caused by its anti-Islam policies?
I'm a little surprised at how people are trying to see this. The point is that if you were to look at the situation of the Muslim community in India, and I'd say from an economic sense, and you have the Rajinder Sachar report, which was brought in when the previous UPA was in power, which basically talks about the extremely vulnerable economic situation of the Muslim community. Now, added to that, you have this virulent attack on the being of the Muslim itself. So whether it's the hijab, whether it's a Muslim street vendor, whether it is COVID, every single context is being communalized. Every single situation is being used for communal polarization. So indeed, you know, this is an extremely, extremely serious situation. But the point is that the pressure that we are talking about comes only at a particular point. Now, from 2014, we have witnessed the lynchings of Muslims. But unfortunately, that did not create that kind of a huge outcry. So the targeting of the Muslims has been happening, you can say, from 2014. It is completely heightened. There's no two ways about it. But there hasn't been any that kind of a corresponding international pressure on the Indian state for it to pushback from its agenda. Its core agenda is this, alongside this crony capitalist agenda it's one of its core agenda is anti-minority.
On that note, I would like to thank Mr. Clifton de Rosario for his precious time and knowledge. Now, let's go to social media to see what people had to say.
Ashok Swain, an academic and analyst, says massive protests have broken out in India, Bangladesh and Pakistan over derogatory remarks about Prophet Muhammad by India's Hindu right-wing regime officials. Pakistan's former human rights minister, Shirin Mazari, asks why is the OIC not calling a special session to deal with the BJP spokesperson's blasphemous remarks and targeting of protesting Muslims. Khalid Beydoun, a law professor and author, calls on the Arab governments to use their power and influence to prevent state terror being unleashed against Indian Muslims.
And that was our episode on the prospects and challenges of economic cooperation between Iran and India and the domestic, regional and global consequences of insulting the Holy Prophet of Islam. We shall meet again next week. So till then, take good care.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked among
the Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
self-purification is the most significant
factor.
Imamat is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, welcome to another episode of the program Ulema's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Ali. Stay tuned.
چقدر این شعرهای حافظ قشنگه. هاتفی از گوشه میخانه دوش گفت ببخشن گنه.
Hafiz, the outstanding Persian poet, says, "Last night a divine voice called and said, 'Our sins will be forgiven, since Allah's power of mercy is more than our power of committing sins.'" It is also stated by Prophet Muhammad that when you finished your salat, read out, "O Allah, I know that I have committed big sins, but your mercy is bigger than my sins. Therefore, forgive me, please."
ما گناهمون بنز خودمونه، ما محدودیم، اما عفو خدا بنز خود خداست، نامحدوده.
We are limited, finite creatures, and our sins are limited too. But Allah is infinite and limitless, and His mercy upon us is infinite too. Allah's forgiveness is bigger than any of our sins. In another fascinating hadith, Imam Ali alayhi salam states, "Allah has 100 portions of mercy, out of which only one portion is showered on His creature on earth. This world has not the capacity for 99 portions of the mercy of Allah, and the rest is only reachable in the other worlds." Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of the program Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Ali. To find out more about this program, log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en, Call of Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care and goodbye.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Flush with cash, a PAC appears to be a heavy weight in this year's U.S. midterm elections as it goes after progressives and floods its preferred candidates with millions. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Jessica Boxbaum, journalist. This article is published under the heading, As the midterms approach, AIPAC throws its weight and money around Washington. Stay tuned for more. Last week, Representative Chantel Brown defeated Nina Turner in an Ohio Democratic primary race for the second time in 9 months. Turner had been endorsed by Progressive Squad member Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and is a vocal critic of the fabricated regime of Israel. Her loss is largely seen as a win for the Israel lobby and specifically the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, AIPAC. In December, AIPAC launched two political action committees, PACs, as a way to be more effective in fulfilling their mission in the current political environment, according to a statement published by the group on social media. In less than 6 months since it was established, AIPAC's PAC has delivered $6 million to hundreds of candidates, becoming the biggest pro-Israel PAC in the United States of America. While its super PAC, the United Democracy Project, UDP, has raised nearly $16 million in contributions. Since AIPAC's PAC operates as a traditional PAC, it can only spend $5,000 per candidate, but its super PAC can spend unlimited amounts of money. AIPAC said in a statement about its fundraising, "Our goal is to make America's friendship with Israel so robust, so certain, so broadly based, and so dependable that even the deep divisions of American politics can never imperil that relationship and the ability of the Jewish state to defend itself." Unquote. Flush with cash, AIPAC appears to be a heavyweight in this year's U.S. midterm elections, as it goes after progressives and floods its prepared and preferred candidates with millions. AIPAC congratulated Representative Brown on her election victory, writing that it's proud to stand with pro-Israel progressive leaders running against anti-Israel candidates. Endorsed by AIPAC, Brown received significant financial backing from the organization. According to campaign tracker Open Secrets, Brown received $83,171 from AIPAC Super PAC, UDP, and nearly $270,000 from its regular PAC, according to the Federal Election Commission. UDP also spent nearly $200,000 against Brown's opponent, Turner. UDP spokesman Patrick Dorton told Jewish Insider about the PAC's election season plans. "We intend to be active in a significant number of races where there is a clear difference between a candidate who supports a strong U.S.-Israel relationship and a candidate that does not or who may seek to undermine that relationship," unquote. Turner was targeted by the lobby for supporting conditioning aid to the fabricated regime of Israel and standing in solidarity with Palestine on Twitter. AIPAC has also had its hand in several other key races across the United States of America. The group had been actively involved in the Texas race between Jessica Cineros and Representative Henry Culler, as well as Pennsylvania's fight between Representative Summer Lee and Steve Irvin. According to FEC filings, AIPAC has spent over $1 million against Representative Lee and a combined total of more than $600,000 from both its PAC and Super PAC for Irvin. We'll be right back. APAC's regular PAC must disclose its donor list, but the super PAC isn't required to reveal contributors' identities. Both PAC's donors are a mix of real estate and finance moguls, but there are some notable contributors. Israeli-American media tycoon Haim Saban contributed the largest amount to UDP, with a donation of $1 million, but he isn't the only company head funneling pro-Israeli campaign contributions. The CEOs of several firms have also donated to the PACs. Ballot Flats brand Tix co-founder and CEO Kefir Gavirelli gave $5,000 to Apex PAC. The founder, CEO, and president of Tasty Brands, David Horowitz, pumped $50,000 into UDP. Jimmy Haber, CEO of BLT Restaurant Group, donated $5,000 to the regular PAC. Fernando Stiu, CEO of Mar Vista Entertainment, which was required by Fox in December, contributed $3,500 to APAC PAC. Grant F. Smith, the director of the Institute for Research, Middle Eastern Policy, IRMEP, sees these donor disclosures as an opportunity for the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement to more strategically target the fabricated regime of Israel's lobby. APAC has really exposed itself in the United States and provided a fairly wide open arena for people who don't like their programs to start talking about their donors in ways that have never been possible before, Smith said. Yet with these significant political contributions comes significant political sway. Mega donor Saban has had a strong foothold in politics for decades. In 2002, he gave $13 million to the Brookings Institution to establish the Saban Center for Middle East Policy, now the Center for Middle East Policy. The center's founding director, Martin Indyk, openly supported the invasion of Iraq in 2003. Saban's money has also kept former President Barack Obama and former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton in line with regard to the Zionist regime. The donations by Israel partisans have managed to keep almost every elected representative in Israel's pocket with almost no exceptions. Alison Weir, American journalist and founder of Research Institute, If Americans Knew, told Mint Press News. APAC's PACs aren't backed just by CEO investors, but also by the organization itself. APAC's own employees have channeled more than $80,000 into its regular PAC. Within that sum, APAC President Betsy Korn poured $10,000 into the regular PAC through her company, B-Vision Sports Media. APAC received widespread criticism for endorsing 109 of the 147 Republicans who voted against certifying the 2020 presidential election results following the January 6 insurrection at Capitol Hill. For Hickson, this development is telling because it underscores the growing divide among American Jews. APAC is becoming increasingly viewed as the Republican wing of the lobby, he said. Since its creation, a core tenet of APAC has been its bipartisanship, but Hickson believes APAC is moving farther and farther away from its original doctrine, explaining APAC hasn't cut off funding to Democrats who will take a pro-Israel line, but the fact that they support the far right and have identified so closely with former President Donald Trump is a significant change because it encourages these splits in a liberal Jewish so-called community. Polling suggests American Jews are becoming more critical of the fabricated regime of Israel, with a quarter considering it an apartheid regime. Democratic voters are also taking a harsher position on this regime, with a majority supporting sanctions over Israel settlement activity and more than 40% believing the U.S. should withhold aid to the Zionist regime. A University of Maryland poll also found that fewer than 1% of Democratic respondents view the Zionist regime as the U.S. first or second most important ally. According to Smith, AIPAC has always purported to be unified voice of the American Jewish community, but that self-proclaimed title isn't true. During the joint IRMEP and American Educational Institute, Israel's influence, good or bad for America, 2016 conference, Smith debunked the lobby's false narrative that Americans who are Jewish are all Israel Affinity Organization members who support lobbying from these groups. According to a 2013 Pew Research Center survey on Jewish identity, 82% of American Jews aren't members of Israel lobbying organizations. Smith accordingly asked at the conference, so who does the lobby really represent? Well, the views and concerns of mega donors, for sure. The views and concerns of a relatively small group of boards and directors and top officials. And of course, the Israeli regime, with which many are in direct and ongoing consultation. With Jewish and Democratic voters becoming less concerned with the alliance between the United States of America and the Zionist regime, the gap between representative and constituents appears to be widening. As Weyer put it, it's a contest between the elites that fund candidates and the grassroots that often want something different. So we are seeing that the elites, almost all of whom are pro-Israel, will continue giving huge amounts of money to candidates and buying a lot of candidates that way.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really in fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners. You're listening to the IRIB English Radio, and this is the program Islamic Upbringing. In this program, we discuss problems, questions, and issues parents have regarding the Islamic upbringing of their offspring. The answers are based upon the Noble Quran and the narrations of Prophet Muhammad, may peace be upon him, and his purified progeny. We have with us in studio today our guest speaker, Brother Al-Musawi. Assalamu alaikum, brother.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
How are you?
I am doing well, if you are doing well.
Alhamdulillah, I'm doing well as well.
That's
Thank you so much.
Hear. My pleasure.
So, Brother Musawi, when we talk of Islamic upbringing, there are stages. And the stage of like 1 to 7 year old stage is a kind of stage wherein you have to treat your children as princes or princesses. You have to give them like whatever they want. But for some parents, this trend keeps on continuing beyond the age of 7, and sometimes it then becomes terrible for them, I must say. What are your initial thoughts on that?
A'udhu billahi minash shaitan rajim. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. I think one of the most misunderstood ahadiths when it comes to parenting is this one. اتركوهم سبعا، ادبوهم سبعا، صاحبوهم سبعا. Leave them for seven, befriend them for seven, let them go for seven. It's a very misunderstood hadith. One that says for the first 7 years, treat them like princes or kings, like you said. It didn't mean that you give them an absolute free control.
Yeah.
It means you leave them in the sense that you only monitor. When they you see that they're heading to the wrong path, you kind of give them a push backwards. Not that you say, you know what, do whatever you want. Why? Because you're free for seven. That's nonsense. You know what I mean? And especially, I mean, if you look at psychology today, they say the most important years of a child's life is the first seven. How could you let him free for the first seven? That's a disaster. That's a disaster recipe for a child to come to this world. What the Imams alayhi wasalam meant by seven is that in this first 7 years, don't try to treat them as adults. Give them that freedom to be a child, to do what children want to do. Have you seen a lot of parents when their kids cry? I mean, I always see this. When their kids cry or their kids act, you know, fussy and stuff, the parents get upset and they start yelling at them. They want them to behave. I'm like, no, he's a child. Don't
act mature.
Yeah, let him be a child, you know.
Yeah.
If he doesn't want to have food and he starts with, you know, arguing with his mom, I don't want to eat this, I don't want to do that. Oh, fine. Let him be. Don't try to make an adult out of him. This is what they mean. But not to give them an absolute freedom.
Free control.
Especially in our day today. I mean, now, if I remember back in the day, I was 10 years old and I could not navigate a VCR remote. You know what I mean? Like a VCR remote has some. I'm like, wow, what is this, a spaceship? Now, a two-year-old, he could navigate through an iOS program.
All right.
You know what I mean? They know how they put your passcode. They navigate to their apps. They go to YouTube. They choose. I've seen this with a two or three-year-old. They went through the application. They went to the saved list, and they got their clips. And I was amazed. And only a three-year-old. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So now I can't just let them be free. By seven, it's already done. He's gone. I can't do much with him. So when we say, you know, leave them for seven, or he's a prince for seven, it means that you have to monitor, make sure he's safe. I mean, as a mother, as a father, when I see my child trying to, for example, touch fire, should I let him touch the fire? Or am I going to prevent him? I'm going
to
prevent
him.
My child, if he could speak, he says, but the imam says, leave me for seven. So I need to touch it. It just doesn't work. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So
basically need to understand this hadith properly. Leave them free for seven has some of the meaning that, which you rightly mentioned. I would want you to say more on that note, but after a shorter break. Dear listeners, stay tuned to IRIB English Radio.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Contact us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is the program Islamic Upbringing. I have with me brother Sayyid Abdullah Al-Musawi. So brother, you were talking about free control giving to children.
Yeah. So we were saying that freedom is not something that we should indulge our children in. I mean, as Muslims, me and you, are we free?
Not always.
Not always. I mean, we have like a very small room to move in, and there are prohibition. There are things that are forbidden for us. There are things we cannot do. We're not free totally. We have, yes, we have free one. We're free when it comes to choosing and making our own actions. But Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has a lot of things that He wants us to do. So we can't say, I'm absolutely free to do whatever I want. No, you're not. You have freedom in certain things, in certain things you don't. Do I have the freedom to go kill people? No, I don't. Do I have the freedom to go steal from people? No, I don't. Do I have the freedom to drive as fast as I can? No, I don't. So there are a lot of limitations. Same thing with kids. When it comes to kids,
understand the concept of freedom.
Yeah, so we can't give them total freedom because total freedom would definitely kill them. I mean, at least, you know, not literally, but spiritually or morally or ethically, it will destroy them.
Yeah.
So we need to have that kind of limitation when it comes to what they can do with their freedom. And especially today when we talk about freedoms in schools in the Western countries, at least from where I'm from, they're giving children at grade 3, right? Which is about, I don't know, around 10 years old, 10, 12. At grade 3, they're giving the children the choice to choose their sexuality. Do you want to be homosexual? Do you want to be this or do you want to be that? I mean,
that's terrible.
It's beyond terrible. Why? But they're doing this under the pretext of freedom, right?
Oh my God.
So you need to have, your child needs to be free to choose. Now they added a new thing recently, which is you can choose if you want to be a he or a she. Right? You can choose your gender now, which is a disaster now. I can't have this kind of freedom with my kids. Or when it comes to matters of faith, you can choose what you want to pray, what you want to worship. That doesn't work. So as a parent, I can't give my children an absolute free way of living or a free way of thinking. I can help them. We do encourage parents to give their children the space to think and become a creative, but based on the fact that we draw the guidelines for them first, right? Because now, even if you look in the social media, you'll see that denying the existence of God is a biscuit and a tea, right?
Yeah.
It's as easy as that. And we have the movement of the atheists now. They're moving very hard and they're pushing the agenda very quickly. And, you know, a lot of people falling for it, a lot of kids falling for it, especially our youth. When they come in an environment where the parents, all they do is pray, don't. So much limitations. And then someone else comes with a nice logical argument that says, this is nonsense. You don't have to pray. A lot of guys, a lot of females, they come to me, they say, the Quran never said wear a hijab. Why do I have to wear a hijab? God doesn't care about what you do. God cares about your heart, your akhlaq. He doesn't want you to pray.
Yeah.
You know, as long as your akhlaq is good, you're not harming anyone.
Yeah.
You know, these things are not important.
Exactly.
And so why are they starting to question these core beliefs? First, because they did not have the proper education from their parents. Their faith is very weak. And more importantly, there are people working very hard. I mean, I don't know if you've seen this on TED Talk, where this lady, a Muslim lady, comes on for, I don't know, half an hour trying to prove that the Quran did not talk about hijab.
All right. We have, TED also, TED always comes up with the speakers who are controversial. We have seen that with the TED speakers. Brother, I'll be talking about that with you after a very short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned to IRIB English Radio.
يا مقضي الخيرات يا مقضي الخيرات.
Regarding the sixth verse of Surah At-Tahrim, the 66th surah of the Holy Quran, that is, O you who have faith, save yourselves and your families from a fire. Imam As-Sadiq alayhi salam said, save your families from fire by enjoining them to do good and forbidding them from evil deeds.
يا مطي الخيرات يا مطي الخيرات.
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. I'm with Brother Al Musawi, who's talking about the changing trends and the disasters, as Brother, you rightly mentioned, that in the Western societies where you're free to choose your gender as a kid and where you're like free to do so many things, it sounds to me like, you know, you're leaving a kid in the dark jungle and trying to tell him go and explore without any safe things. And the point you mentioned before the break was very important, that we have some motivational so-called speakers today who come and try to deny the concept of hijab and so many other things, so many Islamic things, and our kids then come and tell us that Allah cares about the iman and faith. He does not care about your appearance and all. So how can we help our children when we live in a society like that?
I myself have lived all my life in a Western society. And I was raised up in a Western society. And I speak for myself. as a child, I was drawn into that kind of living. And up to my teen years, that's when I woke up. It is extremely hard living in these environments. And the West themselves, they sell the bad morality to us. They literally package it and give it to us. You know that show, The Voice, right?
All right.
The Voice and American Got Talent, British Got Talent, and all these ones. If you do a bit of search, especially The Voice, I'm not sure about the talents ones. The Voice itself was designed by the Jews. And they themselves, I mean, you'll find the report online. They said, we designed this to keep the Muslims occupied.
Oh my God.
So they deliberately working on ways and methods to distract me and you. They have, in 2010, they had an annual meeting in Israel of how they could defame and work so hard to make people have less connection with the Marja'iyya, because they understand the Marja'iyya is a source of a threat. How can they weaken it? So they're constantly working. So when they make products, we are the first target.
All right.
They sometimes is designed for us and specifically for us. And we have this thing that, oh, I want to be modernized. I want to be, you know, I want to live in the modern
Central
age.
Center of attraction.
Yeah, I don't want to live in the dark ages. I don't want to live in the cave. So I need to cope with the trend
changing
that's
world.
Happening, changing world. So we start to adopt without even asking, without even trying to see what the hell is going on. So
yeah.
this is a problem that we're facing as parents. We say, well, you can't do that, right? You have to be at least aware of what's happening to
what
you.
What content is being fed
yeah.
to you.
So when you look at all these speakers, when you look at all this content that's being given to our children, sometimes we as parents, you know, find it very hard to, I mean, a lot of parents, like, they bring their kids to me. They're like, okay, he's got a question. I don't know how to answer it.
All right.
I mean, that's a disaster when your child asks you a question. I mean, alhamdulillah, at least they say, okay, I don't know how to answer it. I will take it to someone who will. So as parents, we need to understand how we can defend our faith ourselves, how we can refute an argument, how we can stand up to all these people that are coming these days with all the ideas. And then I can teach my children. So to go back to your question, I need to give my children the proper education from
yeah.
a young age. I need to slowly put the information in their heads and grow with it.
Thank you so much, brother, for being with us. Thank you so much,
my
dear
pleasure.
Listeners, for listening to the program. If you have any questions, comments, or suggestions, please contact us. Please feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. You can also find us on social media platforms by searching Call of Islam Radio. You can also listen to our sessions again on our official website, that's parstoday.com. Go to Call of Islam. Until another session, fi amanillah, and God bless you all.
Do you know what Islam says? It says that life's the greatest test. It says that life's a borrowed space, returned upon rest. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. 25 meters, 11,865 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.